Among Books is a show where we talk about reading and more. It's recorded in person at Hilltop Books in Northwest Philadelphia. I'm Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media, and on this episode, I chat with Darylise Lyons. Until recently, she was the publisher and executive director of the Chestnut Hill Local, an independent weekly newspaper serving Northwest Philadelphia and southeastern Montgomery County. We recorded our conversation earlier this year when Darylise was still in that position. She's now Chief Revenue Officer for the Bucks County Beacon. For more about Darylise Lyons, please check out the show notes, where you'll also find a reading list based on our conversation. Darylise Lyons, welcome to Among Books.
Thanks so much for having me, Stephanie. I'm so thrilled to be invited.
What might you be reading these days?
I vacillate between reading nonfiction and fiction. The other day, I started rereading The Red Tent by Anita Diamond.
I've never read that. I know of it, but yeah, I've never read it.
Sometimes I'll revisit books, and that one I think is interesting about kind of like the culture of women and what it is to be a woman and what society used to be like in terms of creating connections. And so I'm revisiting that in a very sporadic and nonlinear way, because I'm also reading a book about, well, I'll just be honest, there's a book about anxiety and I'm blanking on the title, but it talks about sort of like bringing meditative practices to the experience of dealing with anxiety. And I have a brain that's overactive, and so I'm finding that to be helpful. And that I say reading in air quotations, because it's sort of, you read two paragraphs and then have to digest something and maybe do an exercise. And so I'm working my way through those two books in a very, very slow way. Yeah.
When might you have read The Red Tent the first time? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but it was definitely pre-COVID. So it's been a while. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder. And one of the symptoms of that is difficulty, you know, that time of the month can be very challenging for me. And so I think that was what inspired me to pick it up again, was I had a particularly challenging month and I revisited that book.
Well, that's the books are companions in that way.
They are. Yeah. And they help us, I think, to see ourselves. There's a wonderful children's book educator, Rudine Bishop. She has this video that was put out, and she has written an essay about this, but she talks about representation in children's literature. And she describes, I'm not going to do her justice, but she describes the value of windows, mirrors, and sliding glass doors. And she says that a window allows us to look into the world of others as an outsider. Mirrors help us to see ourselves, and sliding glass doors invite us to enter into worlds and invite others to enter into our worlds. And she says that she thinks that literature should do all of those things for children, that they should have books that show them worlds that are completely different than their own, and then books that help them to see themselves reflected or elements of themselves, and then books that kind of allow for a more interactive experience. And I think it could be broadened to not just books, but anything that we consume or the relationships that we have. Like, I have friends who are mirrors for me, and I have friends who are sliding glass doors, and I have friends who are windows. I mean, I'll never understand some of what they've been through, and they'll never understand some of my experiences, but we can sort of honor and witness. So yeah, that's something I think a lot about.
Let's go back to young Darylise and what you were like as a child and as a reader.
Sure. So I think I learned to read and write at 4 or 4.5 years old. And when most kids would get in trouble for staying up late and watching TV or sneaking into the kitchen or whatever, I would get in trouble for staying up late under the covers with a flashlight reading the latest book. And then I think there was an incident where I fell asleep in my Cheerios the next morning because I was up so late reading under the covers. And I have been reading voraciously and writing since then, since I was 4.5 years old. And a lot of literature shaped my life. So people can't see me. This is an audio podcast, but I'm biracial, black and white. And my white mother joined Black Books Galore when I was a little kid. She was the only white person who was on the board of Black Books Galore and volunteering, etc. So I grew up surrounded by books with black and brown characters that really inspired me, I think, to want to write and to want to be around literature and to see myself represented in books. And so I think books shaped not just my childhood, but my professional path, and really were a catalyst to my becoming a writer and a storyteller.
Yeah, because you've written, from what I could tell, looking at your website, at least a dozen books, and there are a few forthcoming.
I am working on a couple of book projects that are coming out this year, but that's more, you know, fun and fiction. It's not journalism.
Well, tell us about those projects.
Oh, sure. So I have a book called Biracial Like Me. It's a children's picture book. And that book was in some ways inspired by, we did for On Being Biracial, a series called Youth Voices. Malcolm Burnley and I interviewed 15 young people, and we got some funding from the National Association of Black Journalists, and we talked to them about their experience of being multiracial. And that, plus my own experience of being a sibling, inspired the children's book that's coming out.
Is this your first children's book?
No,
or have you already done one?
Oh gosh, I don't know, my fifth or sixth.
I'd have to sit down. You've done five or six children's books?
I have, yeah. I've written a number of books. I was doing that full time for a while, so I've been very lucky, and I've been very lucky to have wonderful publishers over the years. And then I have a young adult novel that it's out on submission right now with my literary agent, so we'll see how that goes. And then I wrote a book about yoga and the emotional freedom technique. I guess in 2018 that was published. I probably started writing it in 2015. And that book, we did a big revision and an overhaul. So that book is coming out at some point.
Like a
this
second
year.
Edition.
Yeah, like a second edition that I thought was going to be a casual rewrite when my publisher approached me. And then I started working on it and realized, oh gosh, so much of this is antiquated. And so much of this, I have new information and new research and et cetera. So that's been a pretty vast undertaking that I did not expect. But I think that's how I live my life, is I had a background in comedy improv. And so I tend to yes and things, and then realize like, oh gosh, I just said yes to this. I took this on. And I think, is it Shonda Rhimes had the year of yes? I feel like I need to have the year of no. I need to learn to say no.
What is the emotional freedom technique?
Oh, sure. So the emotional freedom technique is something that was founded by Gary Craig. And he was looking at why people can go through the same experience and have very different emotional reactions. He studied acupuncture and acupressure, and he studied EMDR, and he studied all these things. And he came up with this tapping technique that I think is meant to support people in resetting their energy. It works very similarly to EMDR, just to help people to get less stuck in painful internal cycles. It's not a cure-all by any means, but it definitely has been shown to reduce anxiety and those kinds of things.
And is the premise of your book that yoga is an application of
this? It's actually sort of combining the two modalities. So combining yoga and the emotional freedom technique, because one of the things that I found as a highly cerebral person is that I can sit here and talk to you about anything that's ever happened in my life in a very dispassionate way from a brain perspective and never feel anything. And that I used to work in finance, and I worked for a hedge fund. Before that, I was like the number two in a finance department at a medical education company. And I remember at that time, I took my first ever yoga class, and the yoga teacher said, take a deep breath and feel your feelings. And I took a deep breath and I cried for the next hour and a half.
Oh, wow. You really felt your feelings.
I really felt my feelings. Well, I had been suppressing my feelings for a very long time. And that experience of yoga was a huge catalyst for my leaving finance, moving to Philadelphia, you know, changing my whole life. And so the premise of the book is essentially both of these techniques, yoga and the emotional freedom technique, can be incredibly valuable in and of themselves. And I find that tuning into our bodies really helps us to get in touch with what's really going on.
Are there any books that you've read that get into this mind-body connection just in the genre that you've read?
I love Marianne Williamson's work. I think it's really beautiful. I forget which of her books I read that has the "Our Deepest Fear is Inadequate." Oh, okay, it's a poem that talks about how like we as human beings fear inadequacy, but also don't let our light shine in the way that they could. It's about the fear of letting yourself be truly and intentionally yourself and to live your life out loud. It's a really powerful poem. So I like her work, and I like that she doesn't pretend to be perfect. She's like, yeah, I'm a flaw.
Aren't we all?
A messy, imperfect person. Well, sometimes I feel like Eckhart Tolle, for example, The Power of Now, and like his books, they're so esoteric and they're so spiritual. And I'm just like, you know, Like, I just can't access that because I'll never be there. And I don't even really want to be there. I mean, I want to be able to laugh and not take myself so seriously and be gritty and real and make mistakes and literally and figuratively fall down, you know, and that's what I aspire to. I also really love, I'm going to say, The Subtle Art of Not Being an F, which is not really the book about, talks about the mind-body disconnect, but it talks about how, like, we just can't care about everything, and nor should we try to care about everything. It's by Mark Manson. That book has changed my life, not necessarily from a mind-body perspective, but just from a, like, hey, everything is not a 10 on the scale of importance. So figure out what really matters to you, care deeply about those things, and just let the rest of the things go. So, and I still do worry. I think I take too many things seriously, but I've gotten a lot better over the years.
You mentioned that you also did improv, and I wonder whether in the past there are any books on comedy or comedic writers that you've read.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, well, I want to give a shout out to my friend and improv troupe mate, Mary Carpenter, who wrote a book, I'm blanking on the title at the moment, but about Star Wars and improv, which was so great. I think the only improv book I've ever read is Mary's book because she's a friend and she wrote it. Because improv is my only hobby without homework. I have consciously gone into that and stayed a member of two improv teams in the city of Philadelphia for over a decade now because I feel like it is the only thing that I do in my life where I get to show up and I get to play and not take myself seriously, leave it all on the field, and it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. The stakes could not be lower, and I have no homework, and everything else in life, I have homework and obligation.
Right, so the mantra for the future is less homework.
Yes, less homework. If only, if anyone has any tips on how to live a life still earning an A, but not doing homework, that's my aspiration.
There's clearly a whole genre of literature on this topic.
That's true, right? That is true, that is true, yeah.
Is it fair to say that writing and reading are your compasses in life?
I think so. And I think for me, one of the things that is really interesting is I don't always love writing. I'm a little too type A for my own good. Mm-hmm. And often when I take on a new book project, I will experience a tremendous amount of stress because I don't know how it's all going to come together. I feel like this inner urgency to finish the project, to get it all done. And so I don't always love it. And yet I feel like I wouldn't be me without writing. I can't imagine a life where I'm not regularly writing. And the few times in my life where I've taken a hiatus, it's been because of some catastrophic event or experience or some period of like severe illness or whatever. And so, yeah, I feel like writing is integral to who I am as a person, and I can't imagine not doing it, but not every moment is joyful. I guess it's like raising kids. It's like a wonderful experience, and a lot of it is very hard.
There's a lot of tension.
There is a lot of tension. A lot of, but I couldn't imagine life without it. How about you?
I knew you would ask me questions. Right.
Well, you know, I mean, I spent most of my life as a journalist. I'm doing well. We got this far in the conversation without me asking
questions. I was thinking you might be asking
me
questions. Yeah, actually, I've struggled as a kid with reading and writing. And I think it was by the time I was going into the sixth grade at a new school that had a very demanding summer reading list. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, had to read arduous books. And my mom saw me reading, and I was reading with my lips. And my mom said, oh, does it take you a while to read? And I said, yes. I was talking out loud while I was reading. And no wonder I ended up in radio.
Right.
But I loved being among books, always have been. My mom is a voracious reader. And, you know, I'd go to the library constantly. And after school, that's where I spent time, was at the library. And our house was full of books. But reading was hard for me.
It's interesting because, you know, here we are talking about childhood and about books. And one of the most, in retrospect, scarring and shaping experiences of my life was my favorite aunt died of leukemia. Yeah. For anyone who's listening to this, my mom is one of 10 kids. So I'm sure I just offended a ton of people by naming my Aunt Maggie as my favorite aunt. But she was, nevertheless. And she died of leukemia when I was 8 years old. And for 9 months, she was in the hospital. And we went and sort of slowly watched her deteriorate and eventually die. And that was a very hard experience for me as a kid. But one of my favorite books growing up was Bridge to Terabithia. And I don't want to give away any plot twists, but death features prominently in that book. And it helped me to make sense of what I was experiencing and to feel like I don't know that there was meaning to loss or just to be able to love someone and also feel a deep sense of mourning. And I don't really remember exactly because I was 8 years old at the time and I'm now 41, but I just remember rereading that book a number of times in the aftermath of my Aunt Maggie passing away. And I would crawl under, I had one of these beds that was sort of an elevated bed. There wasn't a bunk bed on the bottom, but there was a desk that pulled out and I would crawl under the pullout desk and make myself a little fort. And I would sit in there just reading books. I don't know that it was just an escape. It was also a catharsis. It helped me to process some things that maybe I didn't have the language or feel safe talking to other people about it because everyone was going through the same loss. So yeah, I feel like books were hugely, hugely helpful in retrospect. I think I maybe took it for granted at the time or just assumed that everyone had that experience, but that's not true.
We're going to take a short break now from our conversation and turn it over to Amy Wilson. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library and manager at Hilltop Books, where we record the show.
We're a used bookstore run on book donations, so it's volunteer staffed, open 6 days a week, and it's run by the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library. All of the books in the store are just a third of the retail price on the book. Proceeds from our sales benefit the Chestnut Hill Library. So we support programs at the library, we support the book collections, and we also help out with building maintenance and advocate for the library system as a whole. We love volunteers. There's a range of volunteer opportunities from working in the store to helping us with pop-ups and special events, and our volunteer intake form is on our website.
For more about Hilltop's hours, location, and volunteer opportunities, log on to hilltopbooks.org. Now, back to our conversation.
What's your ideal reading environment?
I used to have this big chair from Pier One that had a big bucket seat.
I know what you're talking about, the wood.
Yes.
Sort of the woven.
Yeah, the woven wood. And then there was this big cushion. Yeah. And I would just sit in the middle of that cushion. And I used to sit there and read and write for hours. And unfortunately, like two moves ago, that chair didn't make the cut. It was falling apart. It had been so well worn. So I haven't really found a replacement for that. I currently read a lot on the couch or in bed, but it's not the same.
You had this nestled wing chair.
In my mind, I think I would love to read in a hammock, but I don't know that I ever have. Just a bit mentally, I just think I aspire to read in a hammock one day.
Before we get to the final question, is there anything that you might want to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
One of the things that I think about a lot when I think about books or reading or just consumption habits in general is it's like going with the stream versus going against the stream. This isn't something that I thought about coming into this conversation, but it's something that I'm thinking about now. Like some of the most meaningful books that I've ever interacted with have been, it's because I did follow my intuition or I did let myself explore something. And this is also true of the things that I've written about, even though I talked about writing can be hard for me at times. I've always gone with things that really lit me up from the inside. So even if they were challenging, I wanted to engage and I wanted to stay engaged and I wanted to learn more. And I think sometimes people try to force themselves to be interested in things that aren't interesting to them or to be good at things that they're just not good at. And I do think there's something to be said for the challenge of working towards things that are hard, but I also kind of feel like I would rather someone read 20 books that they're really excited about and passionate about than try to force themselves to get through one book that they hate and then never pick it up again. And I think about young people in particular and school systems and just how much we're sitting here talking. And I went to school and I love school, you know, I was a double major and a minor and but I missed a portion of 82 out of 183 school days of my junior year in high school. I didn't go to class, and I didn't go to class because I wasn't interested in anything that we were learning. And I felt like it wasn't stimulating. I couldn't see the applications for my everyday life. I didn't feel like the content really mattered or was worthwhile. I would read something and I would be able to do the test after a couple of days in the class. And so I didn't understand the point of going and listening to the questions. And I think the reason I'm saying that is because when I went to college and I got to study what I was excited about and passionate about, I did really well and I loved it. And I think I've made a career out of kind of just doing the things that I love that are really hard, that require me to show up in a way that is consistent and but doesn't feel like work in the same way that doing something like washing dishes or something that I'm and you know, there's some people who love washing dishes and some people who love, you know, cleaning or cooking or any of those things. But I think it's okay to push ourselves, but in a direction that feels aligned with who we want to be and the things that light us up. And so I think that's what I think about when I think about my own experience with books or learning or school or any of that, is like, just, you know, when I look back to my 16, 17 year old self who refused to go to class and was like told, like, you're never going to amount to much. Like, you have so much potential, but like, there is no way that you're going to do any, like, cause you got to suck it up and just do things like everybody else. And I was like, no,
you know, you said no.
No, yeah. So maybe I've yes and it, but that was one no that I and have no. Yeah, that I have stuck to throughout my life and even professionally. Like, I work for organizations and work with organizations that I believe in, and I do journalistic work that I want to do. Like, and not everybody has that luxury or those privileges, but I think that, you know, I go back to my scrappy single mother, and I've been willing to sacrifice a lot to do things that have meaning for my life and that feel true to like who I am and what lights me up.
Well, and especially being a publisher of a weekly community newspaper, that's very hard to do at this moment in time in 2025.
That's
and,
true.
But the value of a community newspaper like the Chestnut Hill Local, we're so much better with it than without it. So it is hard work, and the current media landscape will continue to be difficult, but you and your colleagues and other publications around Philadelphia too are managing to be here and be part of the community and keep those stories going. So thank you for that.
Oh, thanks so much. I think there's still a lot of trust in local journalism, and there's still a lot of, I think, at least in this particular community in Northwest Philadelphia and areas of Springfield Township, I think that people want to come together and they want to be in community and they want to know what's happening, whether it be with the latest development or what's happening on the weekend or what their neighbors are up to or different crises or different victories of local people. I think that there's something for me that's really beautiful about this work.
As we get to the end of our time together here, the question that we're asking everyone are, what are the books that had an impact on you that really have perhaps shaped how you think in the world, act in the world, or live in the world?
Sure. Okay. So Lois Lowry's Number the Stars comes to mind. I loved that book. It was, about just the kindness of strangers and the love of people and the willingness to do hard things. And also, you know, the evil and pain that exists in this world. So that book comes to mind. I mentioned The Bridge to Terabithia. I read a lot of books that were children's books with Black and Brown characters, and I can't remember all of their names, but they just changed my life. I think seeing people that look like me in literature as a kid, I wish I had a better memory for the actual titles. I'll probably remember afterwards and be like, how did I not know that? I think that there's a book, Mary Carr wrote a book about memoir writing that really had an impact on me as someone who was doing a lot of writing about my own personal experiences as an adult. I guess one thing that I'll say, you know, and as someone who works in newspaper publishing, but also someone who's had a number of books published, is that I think because I've been in the industry, and I don't know if this is how people feel who, like, let's say, are filmmakers or whatever, artists in a museum or whatever, but because I've been in the industry and I understand that writing is an art and a business, and that sometimes the decisions that are made for books are made because of the business sense of things or because of the saleability, I write because I love it and I'm always going to write. But I think that the magic that literature had for me as a child, it no longer has. It's still, literature still has meaning for me, tremendous meaning. But I can't really read a book without thinking about what I might do differently, or what some of the choices that authors have made, or some of the character development, or the plot points, or et cetera. And when I was a kid,
yeah, you've seen the inside.
I have. I've seen the inside, and I've written books where I've had to change the ending, or change character genders, or change. And I never mind doing that because it is a business. But I also feel like, huh, like what we read and what we hear and what we like, that's not actually what it was originally intended to be. And sometimes I think the editing process makes things infinitely better. And sometimes I think it numbs them a little bit. And sometimes it makes things more collaborative. And so I don't know. Art is highly subjective. And I don't know that we ever read a book that was exactly what the writer intended, unless it was self-published. And I don't know that we ever take away, like, I just think once you read something, it sort of becomes your own. And sometimes people have read my work and come to me and been like, oh, I love that you did this because of the symbolism, the such and such. I'm like,
it spoke
to you that way, but I did not intend that. I was in a bad mood when I wrote that chapter or whatever. So I find meaning in books, but some of the magic has been like, I find more magic in music or dance or theater, like things that I haven't had such a front row seat to, because to me they're still so mysterious. So I know that's probably not
That's the
answer that you wanted.
That's the reality, right?
Right, right.
For where you are as a reader now.
Right, that's true. And maybe it will shift at some point, and I hope it does. And it's not every book. I mean, some books still evoke a particular kind of magic for me, and those are some of the books that I revisit. Like, you know, back to The Red Tent, I'm so glad to be reading it. And some Judy Blume books, like Summer Sisters, I've reread that book so many times and I never pull it apart. And I don't know what that is, but it's sort of an occupational hazard that oftentimes when I open a book, I'm like, oh, I don't know why they did it this way, and they could have done it this way, and this character is undeveloped. Like, so yeah, I kind of have to work against myself with books at this point, but at the same time, that's not all books, and I do love them. And this conversation has inspired me to read more, whether it be revisiting, you know, old loves, or maybe I should start reading books about subjects that I'm completely unfamiliar with, or expand my horizons in new ways, because I think literature opens worlds for us. And so, yeah, I'll reflect on it. I'll journal about it. I'll journal about it. I'll get back to you.
But your assignment is to do no homework after this.
Oh, darn it. Okay. I won't journal about it. I will refrain from any self-reflection. I will go back to the office and I will forget that this conversation ever happened. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Dear Elise, to have you here on Among Books.
Thanks so much for having me, Stephanie. And I hope that this was meaningful for someone listening.
Well, thank you again, and thanks to everybody here at Hilltop Books for allowing us to come into this very cozy space to talk about reading and more.
It's very cozy. Lots of books, wonderful books. It's a magical place.
Among Books is mixed by Brad Linder and produced by me, Stephanie Marutis of Covenda Media. And a final special thanks to the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library, its executive director and Hilltop Books manager, Amy Wilson, and the many volunteers who make the day-to-day operation of the bookstore possible. Until next time, happy reading.